being detained without charge, prevented from seeing the evidence against you, threatened with deportation to torture, labeled a terrorist. This is what five Muslim men here in Canada have been facing for the past several years. These five men are being held under national security certificates. Under Canadian immigration law, security certificates allow non-citizens to be detained under these conditions. For the past decade, the cases of these men have made their way through the courts. All this while community activists, lawyers, and politicians have demanded an end to the security certificate regime. One of those community activists is Matthew Behrens. He works with the Campaign to Stop Secret Trials in Canada. Matthew joins us on the phone from his home in Toronto to tell us more about what is happening with the case of these men. Welcome to the show, Matthew. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on tonight.
Recently, the last security certificate detainee, Hassan Almri, was ordered released from Guantanamo North. That's the specially built prison for those being held on security certificates. And he's been detained for almost, I think it's 8 years now. How was he able to finally secure his release from the prison?
Well, there's a 101-page decision explaining some of the reasons why Hassan was released. One of the reasons is basically the judge looked at this case and said he was unaware in the common law world of anyone who had been held almost this long without being charged under grounds of national security, and especially on grounds that you could not challenge the evidence. And although the decision itself is not perfect, he did have a chance to look at some of the so-called evidence, and he said a lot of it was based on speculation, and it was not nearly enough to hold someone in detention. Now, unfortunately, Hassan will be under incredibly stringent conditions when he is transferred out of the Kingston Immigration Holding Center. So that doesn't necessarily square up with some of the conclusions of the judge. But nonetheless, I think there's been a turn of the tide in terms of public perception of security certificates, and numerous politicians, as you mentioned at the top of the show, have been critical of them. And the real issue is whether people are willing to live with, you know, watered-down certificates, which are just incredibly dangerous, or whether we have the courage to say these things should not exist at all.
And I know Hassan has spent several different periods of time on hunger strike about various conditions inside different prisons that he was held in. What has been his response to this news about his release?
Well, he's thrilled. He's basically, for the last 7.5 years, been more or less in solitary confinement, with the exception of a time span of approximately 8 months when he was held with three of the other security certificate detainees at Guantanamo North. So essentially he has been cut off from most of humanity for that time, and for him to be able to be in the community, even under these very strict conditions, to be able to, if you can imagine, eat fresh fruit and vegetables for the first time in almost a decade, to have at least a few limited choices about what you can do, it's better than where he is now, but still recognizing the fact that, unfortunately, he has to wear an ankle bracelet which will track his every movement. His phone will be tapped. He's not allowed to have a cell phone or access to a computer with internet access. The agents of the state can enter his home anytime, day or night, 24/7, without a warrant to search the premises. He has to get permission of the government to go down to the corner store and buy a liter of milk. They're just incredibly, incredibly draconian conditions that he will be living under. But at least he will have a little bit more say about what is going on in his life despite that. And I think that will hopefully make a bit of a difference in terms of his ability to face the next few years, which he still has to go through the security certificate hearing, the public portion of that, as well as the hearings, if his certificate is upheld, regarding deportation to torture in Syria.
And I know those other four men are under very extreme bail conditions as well, so extreme that one of the detainees, I understand, Mohammed Majoub, actually asked to be sent back to jail. Can you tell us more about what the men's lives have been like who have been living under these bail conditions for a little while?
Well, it's interesting because the conditions are severe for the men, But the men have been very clear in terms of saying, you know what, they're used to brutal conditions. They've been in jail. Mr. Mejoub's been in jail in Canada and in Egypt, where he was tortured, as has Mr. Djabala. What has been most painful for them is the humiliation of seeing their family suddenly in jail, because essentially what these conditions have done is they've transferred the incarceral environment from the actual prison to the home. So because of the fact that the men have to be with their wives 24/7 because they're the main supervisor, that means the kids can't go out on their own without permission of the government. And so everyone's movements start to be restricted. And when you do go on a family outing, you're closely followed, oftentimes by armed agents of the state wearing bulletproof vests, clearly marked. So imagine going to an amusement park and everyone's looking at you and you're 9 years old because you and your mom and your dad are being followed by these guys who look very threatening. They're taking pictures of you and whoever it is that you say hello to. And also, if you're an individual who's just, you know, walking down the street on one of your outings and someone says good morning to you, you're not allowed to say good morning back because you could be associating with someone that you're not supposed to associate with unknowingly. So it's so Orwellian that it's almost beyond belief. And difficult it is for the men themselves to have to go through this. I think there's a real psychological pressure on them because they're seeing a real sense of sadness and pain within their family, to the point at which the children are saying things like, well, I'm not sure if I do want to go out because of the humiliation that they go through as well in this process. So as a result of that, I think there was just mounting pressure on Mr. Mejoub, as well as just ongoing harassment by agents of the government who are involved in their lives daily. They bring them the mail that has been opened. They photocopy their credit card bills and statements, and all of this information is sent on to Ottawa for so-called analysis. And Mr. Mejoub simply went and tried to surrender himself to the Canadian Border Services Agency and said, I can no longer do this, and I don't want my family to have to go through this anymore. In the end, Mr. Mejoub kind of pulled back and is still with his home. But that's a sign of how severe these conditions are. Most people think, oh, house arrest, that's great. You can sit around, watch TV all day, do whatever you please. But it's not like that at all.
And I know recently it was revealed that CSIS has been recording conversations that these men have been having with their lawyers.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
How was this discovered, and what was the response by the men, their lawyers, and the government to this revelation?
Well, there's as part of the release or the transfer to house arrest conditions, the men are allowed every 6 months to apply for a review of those conditions. And during the review of those conditions, state agents were asked, what do you do with the mail, for example? What do you do with the telephone conversations? And under oath, they said, well, we send them on to Ottawa for analysis. So essentially, this whole process has been a massive data mining operation. And the lawyer said, do you know whether or not our conversations with our clients are recorded? And they said, well, we don't know. That's something that you'll have to find out from Ottawa. As a result of this, there was a secret hearing where the men, their lawyers, were not allowed to attend. But nonetheless, the day after that secret hearing, one of the judges revealed that in the secret hearing, a CSIS agent did admit that they have had exclusive access to the legal strategies of these detainees for the last 18 months to 2.5 years. And what was quite remarkable is the fact that CSIS said, well, we didn't really know that it was wrong. And, you know, solicitor-client privilege is a fairly established right, and the fact that they would just say, well, we don't really know, is kind of just willful ignorance of the law and of basic human rights. The judge in this case kind of looked at it. She seemed to be disturbed, but said, well, there's nothing we can do. What's past is past. Let's move on. There's no remedy, there's no punishment, there's no accountability. CSIS got away with it. And, you know, if this were any other criminal proceeding in which people have a modicum of rights, this case would be thrown out because of severe prejudice, because one side has had access to the other side's strategy.
Wow. So the cases of these men have been in courts, in the courts for years, and where are their cases at the moment? And is there a plan to test the constitutionality of the new security certificate law?
Well, what happened is there was a challenge that was launched by Adil Sharkawi years ago to the whole regime of the security certificates. This was joined in by Mr. Omri and Mr. Harkat from Ottawa. And in the end, the Supreme Court declared that the heart of the security certificate procedure under which these men had been and continued to be detained is unconstitutional. It denies them the right to know the case against them. Rather than allowing these men to go free and back to their families, the court gave Parliament 1 year to come up with something new or just to let it go. Parliament came up with something new, which was basically the old legislation with a couple of window dressing changes, including something called a special advocate, which is a security-cleared lawyer who can go behind closed doors and look at what is there in secret. But we don't know what's going on with that, and once the individual is behind closed doors, they can't talk to the detainee. So the detainee is no closer to knowing the case against them and can't really advise that special advocate what to do. That's part of the process. Another part of the process is to limit the kinds of appeals that can be done. So right now there are constitutional appeals either being planned or have been launched, especially in Montreal, but unfortunately the judges have just said, well, we're going to set them aside for now. Let's see how the system runs. And it's a remarkable thing to see, because when this law was being debated, for lack of a better word, in Parliament, witness after witness after witness from the leading human rights groups in Canada, from leading bar associations, they all said, this thing will not stand a constitutional challenge once again. It sailed through the House and it sailed through the Senate. No problem whatsoever. And so, essentially, new security certificates were issued in February of 2008, and the process starts again from ground zero. So now these men have to go through a whole new security certificate hearing, and the whole deportation process will begin anew as well. So imagine having gone through this for 10 years only to be told we have to start again. And the thing that's interesting about these cases is the fact that, as was revealed in Hassan Omri's case, the judge was very critical of the government, because he said, we haven't seen anything new that wasn't on the record in 2001. The government has had almost 8 years to investigate Mr. Omri, and they're still just alleging the same things they were in 2001. There's no change in their analysis. As far as they're concerned, he's guilty until proven innocent. And I'm hoping that at least some of these judges will begin to see it. But even if they do, the problem is the structure of these things and the standards are so low that basically anyone can have a security certificate upheld against them, because it's the lowest standard of any court in Canada, and it only applies to refugees and permanent residents.
So in terms of the constitutionality, there's a little bit of let's wait and see how these play themselves out. And how long do you think that question will come up again at the Supreme Court, like a few years or?
You know, it's really hard to say. On the one hand, the federal court, which has played a real, I would say anyway, biased role in terms of supporting this process and really being a cheerleader for it. The Chief Justice of that court has tried to, he wanted them all done by the end of December of last year. And they're clearly not going to be done because there's still a long way to go, I think. And it could take a number of years. And, you know, while on the one hand that delays the possibility of deportation for a couple of years, it continues the house arrest. It continues the threat of being rearrested for the slightest little breach, as happened to Mr. Harkat last year, when under circumstances far beyond his control, the government decided that he had breached his bail conditions. Now, in the end, after he had been arrested and jailed, a judge determined that he could be re-released on bail, thankfully. But that's this incredible ongoing war of attrition which is being waged against these guys. And it's slowly squeezing the life out of them and their families and isolating them from their communities, because no one wants to associate with someone who, to visit them, you have to provide all of your intimate details to CSIS to see whether or not you can be an approved visitor. And when you do apply, all of a sudden, you're a target of investigation as well. So there's these huge ripple effects, especially in the Arabic Muslim community in Toronto, Ottawa, and Montreal.
And so when you say that that judge is hoping to have them all done by the end of last year, does he mean, do you mean like, you know, the case is finished as in either that people are deported or the security certificate is, you know, quashed somehow? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Basically, he wants them done. And I think one of the reasons for that is these things are just a huge embarrassment for the Canadian government on the world stage, because other countries have, after, especially after 9/11, 2001, there's been analysis of what's going on, and there have been some remedies. It's not perfect, but if you look at Britain or Australia and New Zealand, even in the United States, they have had cases that have allowed for far more rights for detainees than here in Canada. And with respect to deportation to torture, we still have a Supreme Court whose last ruling on this issue was, in exceptional circumstances, which are undefined, you can deport someone to torture. And that's a real black eye for the Canadian court around the world, and it is being used by other governments to say, see, if Canada thinks it's okay, it should be okay. And we're hoping that these cases will close that door. But nonetheless, that has stood since 2002.
Well, and it has been years since Canadian officials arrested anyone new under this law. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that's because of public pressure. If you look at the history security certificates in their current form in front of the federal court, from 1991 to 2003, CSIS issued between 2 and 3 security certificates a year. After Mr. Sharkawi's arrest, there was just one more security certificate. So for almost 6 years, there have been no security certificates issued. And that's not because the so-called security climate has changed. It's because the political climate has changed. We've been able, throughout the country, in different groups, from Known as Illegal and other refugee support groups in British Columbia, right the way across Canada, a light has been shown not only on these cases and the abuses involved in them, but on the larger questions and on the ripple effects as well. And so I think CSIS has had to back off, and that's a show of the power that we actually do have, even in our limited way, to restrain the state from using these extraordinary measures. Whereas for the decade before, they'd been able to get away with it simply because it was completely under the radar. Very few people knew about them. But through exposure, through public actions, through public resistance, and through our willingness to basically say these people deserve the presumption of innocence, that's made a huge difference.
And in terms of another, I suppose another issue is the amount of resources and money being spent under this system, I think both in terms of the Guantanamo North or the Kingston Immigration Holding Center, as they call it, which now there'll be nobody there, but I've heard that they're still going to be running the place, basically, as well as I understand a student recently did some research into the cost of surveillance of these men. Mm-hmm. Can you comment a little bit on some of that, some of the amount of money that's being spent you know, to keep these men surveilled and detained?
Well, you know, as with all things bureaucratic, the bigger you can blow up your threat, the bigger budget you will get. And because of the fact that these men have been released to people who are supposed to supervise them. So essentially, the court has placed its trust in the wives and the adult children of these detainees. But despite that, the Canadian Border Services Agency, which is celebrated every Monday night on the CBC in this horrific show called The Border, they're playing cop, and they've got a big budget, and they're buying cars, and they're doing weapons training and all this kind of stuff, all of which is completely unnecessary because of the fact that these men are supervised by their sureties. They have ankle bracelets. Some of them have cameras in front of their homes. So what's this all about? The Globe and Mail has done an article about this and said in one case it cost about $800,000 a year to monitor someone. But you know what? That's just chump change in the world of so-called security. The Canadian government has spent upwards of $30 billion on so-called national security measures going back to 2001. And the real question is, what security has that gotten the women of Canada who were murdered by their male spouses? What kind of security has that gotten First Nations peoples on reserves who are still doing boil water alerts? So, you know, I think the whole monetary issue is kind of a little red herring. And it allows for some people to say, why are we spending all this money on these people? Why don't we just deport them? When the real issue is what kind of damage is being done to constitutional rights, which are centuries old, going back to the Magna Carta, that are being very rapidly eroded. And they're being eroded because of the fact that the government has been able to demonize these men and their families as the other. You know, they are dangerous, they're from another country, they're Muslim. And, you know, if people can get beyond their own racism and see what's really going on, I think they'll see that we're next in line.
And it's also a useful way to sort of, like you say, question that idea of safety or security in terms of where we're actually putting our public resources and how we conceptualize that idea.
Well, absolutely, you know, and I'm so grateful for your radio program because there's so few, you know, outlets where we're actually examining what it is we do when we put someone in incarceration. What is the cost to that individual? What are the ripple effects? What's the cost to our society? And what kind of a society are we living in when we throw people into these horrific places where there's absolutely no chance of rehabilitation if, in fact, you need rehabilitation in the first place? And basically, we're brutalizing folks and just continuing the cycle of violence. And whether that's, you know, putting security certificate detainees in or putting people in because they've stolen a loaf of bread, whatever it is, it just shows the rotten core that's at the heart of our society.
And what do you see in the future? I mean, you've been organizing on this issue for many years. What kind of trend do you think is going to happen in terms of what's coming up?
Well, I think it's not just about these five cases. It's about a much larger exploration of the fact that we have different classes of people in this country. We have citizens, we have non-citizens, we have First Nations, and there's so many different tiers of citizenship in this country. And security certificates represent two-tiered justice because of the fact that you weren't born here, you get a different standard of justice. And there are many refugees increasingly who are facing restrictions that have that are taking place because the door has been opened by the security certificate process. So there is a section of the Immigration Act which allows for secret evidence to be used against you, even if it's not a security certificate. The government doesn't have to explain why. If you look at the attacks that are being directed against members of the Tamil community, for example, there's been no coverage of that whatsoever. But if you're a member, let's say in Toronto, the Tamil Youth Organization, and you want to hold a public event on what's going on in Sri Lanka, the RCMP goes to the owner of that public place and shuts down the event. So these things are just the tip of the iceberg, I think. And so I think ultimately what we need to do is question, as you were saying earlier, the whole rationale for the national security system in this country. Why do we need CSIS? What does it do other than terrorize people in this country and set people up for torture overseas, as has been confirmed by two federal inquiries in the torture of four Canadians? What is the role of the RCMP? What is the role of the police? It's really about what kind of a society we want to live in. And I think at the far end of that are the taserings of people in the airport in BC and security certificates and that kind of stuff. And if folks aren't willing to say, you know what, we are really getting to a dangerous point looking at those examples, I'm not really sure what it's going to take to wake people up.
Well, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your perspectives and more about your work around the security certificates and the secret trials.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to look at the issue. It's a real crucial one. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Matthew Behrens. He works with a campaign to stop secret trials in Canada. For more information on the security certificate detainees, you can check out the website www.justiceforharkat.com.